Hello, everybody. This is Jason Wise. A few days ago, one of my best friends in the wine and food business and a truly great friend outside of it, Brian McClintock, stepped down as a member of the Quartermaster Sommeliers. Obviously, Brian was in Somme 1 and was my entry point into the world that I'm now known for, and he certainly was known for. I'm not going to try to get into why he did this. You can read about that on any of his social media accounts. It was for some pretty deep-seated moral issues, and if anyone's curious, I completely stand behind him. You can find his long and really well-written letter in his Instagram profile or a number of other places if you search online. But it made me realize that I recorded a podcast with him at the very beginning of COVID, just him and I, you know, kind of shooting the shit and talking about Somme 1 and how it happened and why it happened and all that, but I never released it. And so now's the right time to release the story of Brian and I, you know, meeting up and how that goofy film that has come to define my career and a lot of the rest of us who really didn't know it was actually going to work, you know, how it worked. So without further ado, here's a lost episode of Somme TV featuring Brian McClintock and I talking about the making of Somme 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Somme TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. I am thrilled that you guys are listening to me right now. I hope in your underpants, maybe with a glass of wine. I don't know what time zone you're in, but who cares? I'm having a glass of wine. It's too early. I'm not going to tell you what time it is. Today is Brian McClintock's birthday, my longtime dear friend, cast member from Somme 1, 2, 3, lots of stuff on Somme TV. I feel like I don't remember a time I didn't have Brian in my life. Happy birthday to you, Brian. In honor, him and I are going to talk about our experience making Somme 1. We've done this before, but we're going to try to do it in a different fashion. This is going to be him and I going off and on topic and talking about our dreams and our goals and how Bob Iger had a part in Somme 1 and just wild stuff. So stay tuned for that. Before that, I want to tell you we have some new documentaries up on Somme TV. We have two James Beard award-winning documentaries that are fantastic. One is called The Scent of Black, about Cahors, which is the region Malbec is originally from in Bordeaux. It's a really, really good look at truffles and the people there, and it's just a great short documentary that's on Somme TV right now. There's also another one called Stewards of the Land, which is kind of a classic James Beard-winning documentary about Sonoma. And it features the late, great Burt Williams from Williams Cellium, which is a winery that really pioneered, one of the major pioneers at least, in fine Pinot in the United States. They are, you know, they've influenced everybody from Whitcraft and Rajat Parr and so many wineries up and down the coast in Santa Barbara and Sonoma on the Sonoma coast. They're really special people and good guys. And so that's a film you should check out. It is streaming right now on Somme TV. We also have our card game Blinders is up for pre-order. www.blindersgame.com. It is the game we made for Blind Tasting. It sold out really quick last time, and it is available for pre-order. We're going to start shipping as soon as we can due to COVID, probably towards the end of May, maybe sooner, hopefully so. I also want to mention that if you are in the restaurant hospitality industry and you're out of work, we want to know. We want to make sure you can afford Somme TV. Just please send us a direct message on Instagram, and we will make sure to get you a subscription. It is very important that you can travel and enjoy things from your couch in your underpants. That's the way people should do things right now. I love that. All right, without further ado, here's my conversation with my friend Brian McClintock about making Somme 1, a real tangential oral history. Here we go. All right, so how in the world did we start with the first Somme movie?
Oh, wow. Well, you and I, so I was working at a steakhouse in Orange County, and you were basically a bartender in Orange County. And you were going to Chapman Film School. I was waiting tables and not doing much else. And I remember very, very distinctly so many nights where all we did was stay up, drink wine, and talk about movies. And then there was a very distinct moment in the summer of 2009 where you really were gung-ho about making your first feature and started to feel the weight of that. And so
I remember.
There was a very distinct moment where I think your head was in your hands and you were almost like tearing your hair out. Like, I've got to make a film before I'm 30. Like, and so I remember just kind of offhandedly saying, you know, like, I'm meeting some weird people right now. I'm doing some weird shit. You know, because at that point I had passed my third level. And so I was technically going to sit the master exam at that point. I'm like, you should see what this training ground is like. And so I think I invited you to, I don't know which happened first. Did you come to Napa Rose first, or did I do the blind tasting with you and Tim first? Which I think happened first, because I think you needed convincing. And so you ended up saying, yeah, I'll blind taste you on a wine. And so you invited me over to your father-in-law's house, and you bought like a Mosel Riesling, probably thinking in your head that German Riesling that's so obscure, like he won't be able to blind taste this. Or I don't know what you thought, but like literally that is the easiest wine on earth to blind taste. So thank you for doing that, because like if you had done anything else and I had gotten wrong, maybe it wouldn't have been interesting for you to even pursue the project. But you blind tasted me on Mosel Riesling. I knew exactly what it was right away. And you're like, how did you know that? Like, and then I'm like, yeah, come to this sommelier training ground. So you followed us with a camera, and you're not a shy person. You can talk.
You're saying I'm not a shy person?
You're not a shy person. You can talk, and you were dead silent for like 5 hours. I've never seen you that quiet, just following people and seeing it in that like intense environment where people are like, you know, the color and the flocculation and, you know, there's no sediment in the glass and people were taking it so seriously. I just had to be like, what is this world? And so I didn't hear from you for like a few weeks after that. And then you called me and said, we have got to make this film. And so I think both of us kind of unilaterally decided that maybe we should get permission from the court before we attempt going any further. And so at this point, I was in Aspen. I had moved to Aspen. And so we flew out to San Francisco in the summer or the winter of 2009, it was December, and met with the court's PR firm, talked to Fred and whoever else was on that call, and they signed off on us, you know, doing this documentary. And so you, for however long, it must have been 2 years, because this was 2009, and you didn't really even start truly filming principal photography until winter of 2011. In the meantime, you got a lot of footage of Ian, and you put out this trailer on the internet at the perfect time, because you really were embracing Twitter at the time, which was on its rise and in its heyday. And that trailer created so much buzz. And you had all kinds of, I think you had, what was it, Michael Eisner called you from Disney, like, hey, how do I get a hold of this movie? You're like, I haven't made it yet. Or like, you know, like all these people reached out to you.
It was a very, the process was very odd. It was, it's kind of like one of these weird dreams. I'm always going to be known for this film. And of course, you know, now having Som TV and making other ones, I mean, I deserve it. But I think I look back at the time of making Som, and it's so funny what you do when you have no idea what you're doing,
yeah,
and how right and wrong those decisions are. I mean, I didn't know what I didn't know, and so I just did that. I put out a trailer, and without that trailer, you know, it got picked up by huge press outlets, and it was kind of like, I hate the word viral, but it was an early day where things could like kind of just
it was a viral
in 1 second explode.
It was a viral thing, yeah. And there was a huge zeitgeist immediately, because no one had ever seen this strange world before. And so there was just a lot of curiosity with you uncovering this unknown part of the world. And so you could see that this film wanted to get made, but there was a giant struggle. I mean, you must have talked to a million people, as did I, trying to get funding for the film.
Yeah.
And that was a nightmare, huh?
Yeah, I think the crazy thing with this film is, in retrospect, it's like everybody's like, yeah, of course Som would work. But, you know, it's hard. and I've told this story a couple times, but never to this extent. I've tried so many times to just get anybody to believe me that it was worth telling. And it was the kind of this thing where like wine on its own was such a niche that it was like, there's no way to, but then there was like wine experts, and then sommeliers are a part of wine experts. So like you're going down three levels in the basement from a commercial standpoint. People were like, this is just not going to work. And I was asking for such, I don't think people listening have any idea what it costs to make a film. And that's, you know, that's a, it, what it costs to make a film is basically how much do you want to punish yourself times how much time do you have squared, and then, you know, divided by favors you can get, and then, you know, cosine, you know, it's just like, there's like no way to figure. Budgets are, what do you have? And so I was asking for the tiniest amount of money. I mean, like in the film world, or what it would cost to actually make a movie, let alone one that actually is successful.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I mean, this movie costs nothing, but nobody would give us anything to do it.
So I literally was met so many wealthy people in Aspen, where I was, who I showed the trailer to, and they looked me dead in the eye and said, listen to me, that idea will not work. I think it's cool, it's nice, but that won't work. And I just got doors slammed in my face, left and right, as I'm sure you did too. Didn't someone want to make it like doors. A Big Brother reality show?
100%. I mean, people, yeah, so Cobble, Ian Cobble's dad knew somebody who's like a reality TV show producer.
Right.
That he connected me to. And this guy, I won't name his name, but oh boy. He wanted to make exactly a reality show. And he likened it to Big Brother with wine, which, I mean, maybe that's higher class than the actual end product. I don't know. But the,
I'm gonna say no.
It was one of these things where I had doghouse doors, garage doors, you know, every kind of door is like the Tommy Lee Jones speech in The Fugitive, like in-house, outhouse, doghouse. You know, I everything was slammed in my face. And now with Sam, it is this thing that I've just had a lot of people go, well, of course it was going to work. You know, look at the characters you had. Mm. Look at X, look at Y, and look at Z. And my, you know, and now that doesn't irritate me. It just makes me know something about documentary filmmaking. Almost 100%. It's not even like 50%. It's like 99.97 and then 1,000 nines is your gut. And the only thing that separates, you know, there's a lot of filmmaking technician stuff involved in making a movie, but I will say that stuff is such a distant second to your gut and trying to just follow what should I actually be filming with the time, the money, and the equipment that I have. What direction should I go? Where should I move? And the thing that never wavered with Sam, especially with you, is that this is a good story. And it's up, as long as I don't mess it up as the person telling it, it's going to be excellent. It had all the elements of there was an end. Some of you were going to pass or not, or some would. I mean, we already knew where it was going. And that is nearly an impossibility for a documentary at all. You may say, like, here's a guy building a boat. But you don't know if the end of the film is when he finishes the boat, or if he puts it in the water, or if he dies on it. You don't know when you start that film. But when I started this film, I knew we are building to an exam, building to something, which has, of course, its own challenges. But I think with this particular movie, it's funny to look back and think a lot of people doubted it. You know, they really did.
Yeah.
And now that you look back with what I do know, of course they did. I mean, there's the percentages of films that work, probably documentaries that don't work, is way higher. I mean, the percentage of documentaries that actually make any money, let alone their budget back, let alone any money past that. I mean, it's so minuscule. I don't even think it, you know,
You got funding amazingly, and let's look at the percentage of films that actually even make it into a festival to get seen. And almost 100 out of 100 require some sort of sales agent. And you're like, no, I don't need a sales agent. I'm like, Jason. So we met in Hollywood with the head of the Napa Film Festival. And I just sat there and watched you broker that deal, which was incredible, you know, with no sales agent. And You well, got everything you,
know,
you
I
wanted.
Just, I believed so much in this movie. And it also was like, I had no backup plan. I still find myself in this position. You know, I still have no backup plan with my projects. And I am a very frustrating person to work with because I'm all in. You know, I mean, I'm all in. So when Napa Valley Film Festival was interested in showing it, we had been turned down by 50 film festivals around the world. They I don't even know if they watched the movie. It just got turned down on principle. But there are these films that work, you know, King of Kong. I think, you know, we've talked about it at length before, Pumping Iron. Documentaries that are kind of horse race, great personalities moving towards an event. And I believe every 5, 6, 10 years, one of these films comes. And it always seems to come out of nowhere, like, wow. But the formula is not that much different. And I knew that this movie had the elements of previous documentaries that had been successful and worked. And I had the characters. You, Ian, I mean, DeLynn, Jesus. You guys, and Dustin, you guys are such dynamic people on your own. And good people. And so I just thought, man, maybe I'm completely delusional. Or I know something others don't. It was Bob Iger, by the way, who reached out to me from Disney. And he was the very first person who reached out. And I think I may have told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again really fast. He reached out to me, and I thought it was a joke. I thought all my buddies from Cleveland, Ohio were playing a joke on me because I got this woman who called him after the message and said she was Bob Iger from Disney, Walt Disney Company, his coordinator. And I mean, I called some of my friends back home and I said, you know, stop fucking with me. I know that this is a joke and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they looked at me there. They were blank. Like, I'm not messing with you. I'm not pretending to be Bob Iger. So I called this woman back. She connected me with him and he asked to see the film and he sent a courier over to my house, picked up a DVD or two, watched the movie right away, called me right back, told me he loved it, talked to me for quite a while about it, his wine collection, his friends who drink wine, you know, all of this other stuff. And then he asked me, he said, I'd like to buy, you know, a couple hundred copies to give to my friends of this movie. Who's the distributor? And I thought to myself, like, if there was a distributor, you wouldn't have had to call me. I don't have a distributor. And he kind of gave me this response of like, I think he was in awe of like, how the hell did I hear about this movie? It's kind of how he felt. And I know from now reading his book, he's an obsessive researcher and he wants to be one step ahead of the market. So he's always looking to see what's coming out. What are people interested in? But I think, you know, it was this moment where I realized I have something with this film and I need to slow down a tiny bit and be a little more patient. And then we went all out with the Napa Valley Film Festival and ended up opening that festival.
Yeah.
And that was a moment where I realized what I already knew, that nothing is written the way it's supposed to happen. And someday when I'm older or now, a young filmmaker or someone who wants to start a restaurant or somebody will come to me for advice, and this is the advice I will give them. There is literally nothing written. The way you think things have to be done, it's not only not true, but it's absolutely, it's murderous to the way they can be done. And so when somebody tells you you can't do something without an agent, or you can't do something without a sales agent, or you should go to film school, you have to do that, or X, I think, and maybe this is an American kind of attitude here, my automatic response to that is that's bullshit. You can do it. You can do it yourself, and you should if you can, especially if you have no money like we had on Sam. I didn't have the choice. And I also was so afraid because I cared so much about you guys and the way you looked and not the way you – I mean, I just didn't want somebody manipulating the story like a reality show. I didn't want someone recutting it. And so I very much held on tight to it, which has benefited the series. I've been able to make multiple ones in this series because I controlled the rights to it. And if I didn't, somebody else would have made Psalm 2, and guess what it would have been? The exact story with just different candidates. And whether that's a better choice or not, I don't know. But I think there are ways to approach something that's a mixture of business and art, which are two things that should never mix, but they have to in my field, on your own terms. And I've tried very hard to do that. And now
here we are.
I'm about to release my fifth feature film right now. So it's an interesting thing.
Here we are 11 years later and you've got Psalm 4 on the heels.
Yeah. So yeah, we have Psalm 4 on the heels and this one is the one that, you know, I've earned the right to tell a story about the origin of Christianity and wine and everything, you know, in the Middle East and the Caucasus Mountains. And I get to do something like that because of what we did with together back then. And it's an astounding journey, but I also, you know, I got to make Delicacy, which is the film about sea urchin divers. And I would never, nobody's going to let me make these films if I haven't proved in the past. Yeah.
I cannot wait to see that film. I mean, the trailer looks incredible.
Yeah, it's I'm very proud of it. I'm really proud of it. Really, really proud of it. But so, yeah, so then the film itself, you know, it ended up, there were several distributors who reached out not long after it premiered at Napa.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them stuck, which was Samuel Goldwyn Films. And, you know, for a documentary to be successful and then get, I mean, we had a theatrical release. We played in theaters all over the country.
Yeah.
And we did it again with the second one, which is kind of an amazing thing. And I think I've decided something because I think a lot of people, filmmaker-wise, I see this all the time because I'm obsessed with a lot of different filmmakers and cinematographers and editors. And when you make your first film, let's say it's like Swingers, if you're Jon Favreau, who wrote that, or let's say it's like Scorsese made Boxcar Bertha, but then his first real film was Mean Streets. Or if you look at like Greta Gerwig, who acted in, you know, Frances Ha and some truly amazing films, but now has made Little Women, which I think was one of the absolute best films of last year. You look at your first movie and you start to think like, I'm famous or known for this particular project. And a lot of people backpedal and they say, I don't want to be known for X. You know, because you want to have a nice wide.
You want me typecast.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to be typecast. And I remember my father-in-law and everybody saying, you have to make films that are not about wine or else you're going to have to do that forever. And I have made, you know, I made a film about an actress named Rosemarie and that's about Hollywood. And I've made the sea urchin diver film and I have a film about using the whole animal in meat coming out. But I will also say something I made a decision and I have a wife who's much smarter than I am who's helped with this is not to abandon what made people want to come on my journey in the first place, which was a film about wine. Instead, what I've decided is I'm going to look inward on that subject and I'm not afraid to keep, it's not going back into the same well because I've never made a film that was like the previous, never. I've been able to explore so many different stories with wine and now food that I don't even think it is typecasting at all. Because, you know, I'm going to make a film about the Nazis and war in Europe, but yeah, wine will be at the center. And I have a tremendous announcement coming that I'm not allowed to do. You and I can talk on the phone afterwards about another film that has to do with wine, but I don't think anybody would call it a wine film because I just find wine and rum and cider and beer and noodles and dumplings and, you know, oysters and all these things to be like a piece of paper. You can write anything you want on it. You know, there are so many people whose hands have touched these things and who have died and struggled and loved and made love around it. And there's just too much. And so I don't know. I'm all of a sudden like kind of, you know, I'd started Psalm TV and there was half of me that was like, what have I done? I've built a prison for myself in the world of wine. And then the other half of me's got a great glass of wine in their hand with a map of ancient history and of other things going, you idiot, do you understand what you get to do? You're not building a prison.
Can you make
you're
a documentary
building a
about
beautiful
the
continent?
Can you make a documentary about the Sham Wow guy? Can we do that?
I would absolutely. We just need to. We need to. My goal would be to have you play the Sham Wow guy in reenactments.
I'm in.
Can we do that?
I'm in, dude. I
mean, the thing we did about the shake weight, you know, with you just didn't work out. Very well. So
yeah, it just got a little bit. Yeah, doing like, you know, documentary style with that, it just got a little jarring. People got nauseous watching it.
Yeah, it was very sexual as well. So it's tough.
No, but I think like you can make really, as long as the story is compelling and the elements are there, you can do whatever the hell you want. And so, you know, fortune favors the bold, and certainly the beginning of your first feature film was bold in every way, how you went about it. completely unorthodox. You carved your own path and forged it and believed in the product, and ultimately films that are great and stories that are compelling just find a way of getting seen and made. So, yeah.
Well, that's the other thing too, I think, is like an artist, and you also as somebody who works with winemakers that are, I use this word as with an honor, obscure. You know, you work with winemakers and now cider makers and everything else that are, they're not in the normal lexicon. You don't find their stuff at the local supermarket. So, but they make great stuff. And I think you and them and I have the same opinion that if you make something good with integrity, it will rise to the top. Now, the question is, can you pay your rent in between all of that stuff?
I think we need to redefine what we need economically and what we don't need. And I think getting like a lot of the cider producers are doing that. They have their own food, they grow their own food, and they live with a lot less, and they're comfortable with that. They're comfortable with that existence. They have everything they need. I think that's an important theme for us going forward. Is obviously we need to pay rent, we need to take care of our kids, but we need a lot less than we think we do, I think. So
yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. But I do think I don't disagree. I just have to, this equilibrium has always been hard in my life. You know, it's always been pushed so hard for my projects, and then oh my God, I have a family and that's way more important to me, and then you have to bounce the other way. It's so hard to stay in the middle of life. And I think that's the same
You're just a passionate creative, and you care about your projects above all. You know, you pour everything you have into something. Yeah, I think that's just pure passion from you. You know,
pure insanity. But it's also kind of where I see you going with your respect for the world. You know, and the environment and global warming and all that stuff. It's a matter of like with what I think with you, you're going to have a lot of people listening to you. Hopefully you can stay in a place where people can relate to you still, because it's so tough. The more you know about what we're doing and how it's affecting things, the harder it is to talk to the person who has no knowledge of that and just eats, you know, Twinkies and frozen pizza and doesn't. But that's the person who needs to learn. It's not the people who already know.
Right.
That's the trouble.
Yeah, I think you know, I didn't grow up poor, but I grew up middle class, and I grew up in poorer neighborhoods, and my parents taught inner city, so I grew up seeing a lot of poverty and how people lived. And I have a tremendous heart for people who grew up not having a lot. And I know you came from fairly humble beginnings too. And I think as we move forward with cider, and I have a fairly high-end business, I really want to figure out ways that we can use agriculture to grow super healthy, affordable food, and really create educational programs that help impoverished communities learn how to grow their own food communally. You know, because I feel like not only would that be way better than whatever they're buying in a supermarket situation on closeout, but, you know, the cost of growing your own food and learning how to forage, it changes everything economically.
I love it, man. I miss this.
Yeah. Fun stuff, dude. It's good talking to you.
We need to do this more often.
Yeah. All right, buddy.
All right, dude. Well, listen, you behave yourself, and hopefully we get a chance to
I will channel my inner ShamWow for you.
That's what I like to hear.
Get inside that character.
All right. I will talk to you soon, my man.
All right.
Much love to you.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the SOMTV podcast. Next week, I have Matthew Kaner, who is the founder of Bar Covell, an Augustine wine bar in Los Angeles, two very, very influential places here. And he's going to talk about his experiences with COVID-19, his employees. It's something you really should listen to. It's an amazing story and something that is very important right now. Please be safe. Please hug whoever you're quarantined with. Talk to you very soon.